Today on Doomed, we have a metaphorical bedbug problem on this episode of the show. That's right, ladies and gentlemen, today we're talking the New York Times' very own Brett Stevens. And joining me, your host, Matt Binder, is Dave Karp, an associate professor in the School of Media and Public Affairs at George Washington University, but most importantly, he's the guy currently feuding with Brett Stevens because he called him a bedbug. Folks, as always, you can support this show at patreon.com/mattbinder, subscribing at youtube.com/mattbinder, and the podcast at doomedpod.com. And without any further ado, Professor Dave Karp, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks.
You broke up a little bit.
I said thanks for having me.
There we go. Yep. No, I couldn't hear you at all, actually. But thank you for joining us. Yeah. You know, tech issues happen on this show. The audience is used to it. Sound good now? That's what matters most.
Perfect. Let's chat.
All right, Dave. So basically, let's start at the beginning here, because I think everybody who at least listens to this show is somewhat familiar, at least with, they went on Twitter last week and saw Brett Stevens or Bedbug or Brettbug trending on Twitter. And, you know, maybe they checked out why, maybe they didn't, but why don't you tell us what's going on?
Yeah, so I made a Twitter joke. It was the first week of classes. I had just taught class. I logged onto Twitter. There's a headline about how there are bed bugs in the New York Times newsroom. And I'm one of the many people on Twitter, every time Brett Stevens has an article up, we talk about how it's a really irritating article. You complain about the quality of his writing. And you end up talking about how, God, it just seems like the New York Times newsroom cannot get rid of this guy. So I thought for my, at that time, pretty small Twitter audience, that it would be funny to write, the bed bugs are a metaphor. The bed bugs are Brett Stevens. I wrote that, went about my day, walking home, and at the end of the day, and noticed that I've gotten 0 retweets and 9 likes, which is like, I thought I could get like 3 retweets, 20 likes. Like, I thought this was like a slightly better joke than that. Again, and like, not my best work, not my worst work. And then that night, Brett Stevens sends me an email from his New York Times account titled, from Brett Stevens, comma New York Times, CCing the provost of my university, which is like very, very big guns, to yell at me because he thinks I've set a new record for indecency on the internet by calling him a metaphorical book. Yeah, you know, he sees the provost. He tells me that I should come up to New York, come to his house, meet his wife and kids, and then call him a bedbug to his face, because then I, at least I would have intellectual integrity. And he says that he'll be civil about it no matter what happens. And, you know, that's ridiculous. The serious part is, like, I'm a tenured professor, so I'm not scared. The serious end of this is, if he's spending his Monday night looking around for mean tweets on the internet, he's probably also sending them to people who aren't tenured professor, people who he can have a real effect on. So it's really not cool what he's doing, and it's really funny that he's doing it to me. So I then post to Twitter, a well-known New York Times columnist just sent me this email. I made a joke about him with 0 retweets, 9 likes. He doesn't like that I called him a metaphorical bedbug. About an hour after that, with much of Twitter saying, you have got to show us this email, I posted the email, which was even funnier than I made it look. And yeah, that's been my week. How's your week been? Chaos ever since.
I mean, you know, I'm someone who sort of relishes in that type of stuff. So I wish I got that Brett Stevens email.
Right.
Oh, man, this is fantastic. You know, the funny thing is, I mean, clearly, Brett Stevens is not a bedbug. His, you know, his skin isn't thick enough. They've got a pretty, you know, their exoskeleton's pretty thick. You
know,
this guy's got such a thin skin. Yeah. It's amazing. You know, the weirdest thing to me is that, You know, we are now a week away. We'll go back and talk a little bit more about that email, but we're now a week away now from a week out from when he sent that email and this whole thing went down. And, you know, you'd think for people who are just listening to this show and haven't really been paying attention to the feud, they'd be like, oh, why is Matt now talking about this, you know, this funny thing that probably lasted for a day or two on Twitter? Why is he talking about it a week later? Why don't you tell us while we're still talking about Bret Stephens and this bedbug thing? This is actually where it gets a little bit less funny.
Right, right. So, yeah, this really, like, I spent the day Friday kind of happy that it was clearly over. Like, my Twitter mentions had calmed down. Like, he had said a thing on MSNBC about how this is the language of totalitarian regimes, which, for your listeners, if they're wondering, I am not a totalitarian regime. I'm a guy who teaches grad classes in political communication and writes books that they almost definitely don't read.
I'm sorry, did I not correctly introduce you at the beginning?
Really not a totalitarian government.
Did I not correctly introduce you at the beginning of the show? Emperor Karp, did I not?
Right, yeah, right, exactly. I am not an emperor. But so he says that on MSNBC and people make more fun of him. He had quit Twitter and people were making fun of him. By Friday, it is clearly over. I'm happy about that. And then he comes out Friday night with an article in the New York Times itself, which anyone who's followed this at all, anyone who's been on the internet for the week, it's very clear that it is a thinly veiled subtweet that is calling me a Nazi.
Right.
And that's less funny, right? Like, that's when the joke gets weird and awkward. So the argument that he makes in the article is, you know, the Nazi regime compared Jews to bedbugs. They used radio to do it. That propaganda is part of what led to World War II. And whereas they had radio, now we've got Twitter. And people are too mean on Twitter, particularly the left. And the people who are most vulnerable of all on Twitter in 2019 are moderate Republicans. Which, like, first of all, every reader who's been online knows exactly what he's talking about in this article. He's very clearly saying that guy, Dave Karp, and all the other people who are mean to me, like, they're the real Nazis, which, not cool. But, like, also set that aside. Let's pretend there's no subtweet. It's 2019. How can you imagine that the people most vulnerable on social media are moderate Republicans? Like, where have you been, man?
Right.
So that got weird.
To really make people understand, this isn't like, you know, I'm sure we've all been online and tweeting and then some like actual like, you know, shit poster or actual, you know, alt-right adjacent person, you know, tries to throw it back in your face when someone calls them a white supremacist or a Nazi and they go, no, actually, you're the Nazi. Like, that's not what this is. This is a New York Times columnist writing in the New York Times, like, this will be out there forever, calling you without using your name, but still, everyone will know, they'll go back and be able to figure out what he's talking about, saying that you are a Nazi. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, yeah. Also, just so your listeners know, like, yeah, I'm Jewish. Just another layer of really not cool, man. Like, really, the real Nazis are the Jewish professors who said a mean thing, not even to you, but about you on social media a week ago. We got bigger problems here. Come on.
Right, right. First they called me a bedbug and I did not speak out, you know? Like, it's like, it's unbelievable that this...
That was great. So Senator Brian Schatz tweeted something like that in response to it. He said, first they came for first they came for the moderate New York Times columnist and I said nothing. Because they had New York Times columns, and also they weren't coming for them. Like, come on, man.
Right.
It's been a weird week.
You know, and the thing that really gets me, and this is something, I actually pulled that MSNBC clip because there's something I want to bring up in it. I'll play it. I'm not sure if you'll hear it on your end, but I'll let you know when it's over. You know exactly what I'm talking about, the clip, though.
Yeah.
But the thing that really, you know, bugs me about all this is that this is a guy, and this, I don't think this has been pointed out enough, actually. This is a guy who, and someone went back, and credit to whoever did this, went back into his old Wall Street Journal writings, and this guy who says calling someone a bug is fascism, he's on record in the Wall Street Journal equating the Palestinians, an entire race of people, to mosquitoes. it's stunning that he would all of a sudden find this to be so unbelievably fascist when it's thrown back in his face. Bizarre. I mean, let's play this clip, actually, because there's something that I think we should call out here that he tries to get away with, and I want to make sure we don't let him get away with it. Playing this clip now.
I'm going to be careful with my words, okay, because I know these are going to be examined carefully. So I think Twitter brings out the worst in its users. It tends to bring out the worst in its users. And yesterday, a professor at George Washington University described me as a bedbug or a metaphorical bedbug, just in the context of the New York Times having a bedbug problem in our building. And I think that kind of rhetoric is dehumanizing and totally unacceptable, no matter where it comes from. So I wrote him a personal email. I didn't go to Twitter. I wrote him a personal email, which I think was very civil, saying that I didn't appreciate it, that I would welcome him to come to my home in New York, meet with my family, and see if he would call me a bedbug to my face. Because a lot of the things people say on social media aren't the things they're really prepared to say in one-on-one interactions. I also copied his provost on the note. People are upset about this. I want to be clear. I had no intention whatsoever to get him in any kind of professional trouble. But it is the case at the New York Times and other institutions that people should be aware, managers should be aware of the way in which their people, their professors or journalists interact with the rest of the world. That's certainly the case with me at the New York Times. My editors are always aware of what I'm saying, and I've sometimes been called to account, rightly so. He then posted my email on Twitter, so people are free to go and look at what I had to say. All I would say is that using dehumanizing rhetoric like bedbugs or, you know, analogizing people to insects is always wrong. We can do better. We should be the people on social media that we are in real life.
I would agree with that.
Now, the reason I played that part of the clip, and I think it was important to play, is that he really stresses on live cable television that he wasn't out to get you fired or in trouble in any way. What he really was out to do, the important reason, was just to CC your provost, your basically your boss, like you said, was to just, you know, make them aware of what, you know, one of their professors, I guess, in actuality, one of their employees was doing online. And his argument is that, you know, he CC'd him on it with the email, so you saw what he did. It wasn't like he was going behind your back trying to, you know, sneakily get you fired while playing tough guy, telling you to come to your home and call you a bedbug in front of your wife, his wife and kids. But something after that came out, well, you mentioned it. He actually wasn't so truthful about just contacting you and your provost in that one email.
Yeah, so he CC'd the provost on that email. And then it looks like after I posted about the email, after I said this guy, some New York Times columnist didn't mention his name, mind you, didn't like this tweet about being called a metaphorical bedbug. I'm the associate director of the School of Media and Public Affairs. He found the email address of the director of the School of Media and Public Affairs. So I guess, I mean, he's my colleague, but effectively my direct boss. And he sent him an email saying, hey, so I contacted this professor of yours about this. He called me a bedbug online. And, you know, he just posted about it on Twitter. So it seems he's not properly apologizing. So I hope you can get him to apologize. This is, I don't have the language in front of me, but that's, you know, basically what he said. Which, again, like, this works at the sentence level, but not the paragraph level. Like, the idea that he wanted to make sure that the provost and my director knew what I was saying, and he wanted to express to me that what I was saying was an awful thing, but he wasn't trying to get me in trouble. That, well, no, you're trying to call the management to say to the management, look what's happening with this person, you got to do something about it, and then throwing up your hands and saying, well, I didn't say what you were supposed to do about it. I just wanted to make sure you know that I'm terribly offended. Like, he's challenging, he's assuming that everyone who's listening to him lacks even baseline intelligence.
Right, right. And like you mentioned, you're a tenured professional. People don't understand, what does that actually mean? Like, what is that? What sort of protection does that give you from a New York Times op-ed writer?
So, tenured professor means that it's very, very difficult to fire me, that I have done enough research and teaching and service over years. It's usually about 6 years once you land a tenure track job. And then if you earn tenure, it's not impossible to fire you, but it's very hard. And all professors have free speech. All academic freedom is an important priority for everybody, but it's a priority that's more tenuous when you're pre-tenure. If that had gotten sent when I was still an assistant professor, it would have been effectively pretty terrifying. It probably would have silenced me, because up until that moment, the provost running a big university doesn't know who I am, and you don't really want to be the professor who shows up on the provost radar as the guy who's joking around online and getting the New York Times pissed off at him. So that would have had a silencing effect if I'd been a more junior professor, if I'd been me 4 years ago. But as a tenured professor, not only did I know I hadn't done anything wrong, but also I knew that there wasn't really any consequence that I was directly going to face. So him being ridiculous meant that I could react appropriately and ridicule him.
Right, right. So, you know, for listeners of the show, by the way, along with the numerous other reasons why I could never become a tenured professor, going 6 years without joking online would be one of them as well. But anyway, you know, you brought up something really interesting earlier, and I want to go back to that. And that was that, you know, you being who you are, you know, not just the tenured professor thing, but, you know, you're able to go out and you're able to, you know, say what you said, and the consequences are what Brett Stevens did. And then on the opposite side, you know, the consequences of Brett Stevens is facing as a, you know, 40-something-year-old white man working in a very nice job at the New York Times. I'm sure it pays very well. He's able to do what he did and, you know, not just, you know, get called just the worst thing he's ever been called, apparently, seems to be a bedbug. But on top of that, he's able, looks like so far, to do everything he just did to you and face no consequences either. And you bring up that, you know, in this day and age online, and, you know, I'm sure you can speak from this too as someone who teaches in this digital media realm, you know, that's not the case for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Yeah. Look, this has been easy and funny for me because I'm a tenured white guy. Which means that I'm not the target online that so many other people are. There was very little at risk for me this entire week. It's also been an easier week for Brett Stevens. The right doesn't like Brett Stevens. Donald Trump tweeted about this, making fun of the guy. And the fact that the right doesn't like him either, there have been articles in Breitbart, there's been articles in Fox News and Daily Caller all taking my side in this argument, which is a weird, bizarre world. But everyone lining up against him meant that in all of this, I haven't faced the trolling that is so often associated with these social media scandals. You know, when you're in the center of a social media storm, things usually get really bruising and potentially dangerous. And it's been like lighter and funnier for me. I mean, Friday night was not funny. Getting called a Nazi in the New York Times, not a fun day. But besides that, this has been the easiest social media storm somebody could be in the center of. But also, the other side of that is Brett Stevens, it looks like, is just kind of another column on Tuesday or Friday. He's just going to keep doing what he does, just with a new nickname, because it seems like there's not a lot that he can do that's going to embarrass the New York Times enough that they'll bother to go find a conservative writer who works harder at his job and isn't as vindictive as he is.
Right. It's really... It bothers me a lot, actually, that, you know, in the Trump era, there's been a real push in these legacy publications, such as one as important as the paper of record, the New York Times, to really go out of their way to sort of let these they're in very small numbers, but I feel like they speak as if there's some large population making up like 50% of the country who they speak for. These never Trump or anti-Trump conservatives like Brett Stevens. How they're able to just not only get all these platforms now, being the respectable Republicans, but they seem to get away with so much. Like, again, let's just stick with the Brett Stevens example. I mean, this is a guy who's been writing for the New York Times and has, this isn't like the first, like you said, like the reason you even call him a bedbug is was when a Brett Stevens column comes out, it's almost like everybody just piles on the guy because he really is bad at what he does. I mean, this is a guy who's a never Trump conservative who rails against climate change. He's a climate denier. Mm-hmm. Although, to be fair to him, he calls himself agnostic on the issue, which, of course, what a great issue to be agnostic on, right? I mean, And then on top of that, this is a guy who, and this is to me the real kicker. This is one of the leading, like, he's not one of those intellectual dark web guys. He's not an IDW guy, but he might as well be because he's in the same ideological spectrum as these guys. But he's one of the main voices out there who, if a student is told to not hurt an LGBT student's feelings on a college campus, it's like a bat signal goes out for Brett Stevens. And he's got to write a New York Times column about how a conservative has been, his freedom of speech rights has been taken away from him because someone dared to tell him not to say something about, I don't know, a black student on campus or an LGBT person on campus or, you know, anyone who isn't a conservative, basically. Here's a guy who's trying to go after you for you basically just using your right to free speech.
Yeah, and what that points to is that the conversation about free speech, particularly conservative speech on college campuses, is usually about privilege and power. Right? Like, what they're saying is free speech for us and civility for everyone else. We should be able to say whatever we want to say. Everyone should feel challenged by it, and then everyone else should be nice to us. If we come to your campus with a big speaker's fee, there shouldn't be any protesting. Everyone should politely listen and be civil, and then I should get to walk away with my speaker's fee. And anyone on the other side who I disagree with, well, they should get pilloried. They should have their bosses called. They should get shamed for ever saying anything that we don't like, because that would be uncivil.
So what as a professor of you know, digital media and what is this going to, like, how are you going to, I mean, you're definitely going to bring it into your classroom, I assume. Like, this is a,
already have, man. Already have.
So what are you telling your students? This is great. I got to hear a little bit of what's going on with how you're using this in the classroom, because this is a perfect life-like lesson for the future journalists of America.
So I teach a class in strategic political communication. We always start the class session with what happened in the news this week. And we talk about the scandals that we're seeing in the news. We talk about how it relates to the readings. We talk about the strategic lessons we can get from them.
And how often? You froze on Skype. Sorry about that.
Again on Wednesday, and
just go. Froze. So just go back a little bit.
2 days a week. Sure. I teach a class on strategic political communication. We always lead with what happened in the news this week. So scandal breaks. We talk through how it relates to the readings. We talk about the strategic lessons we can draw out of it. So I taught class on Wednesday, and we went through, how did we get to this point? What are the choices that he made? What are the choices that I made? What could each of us done differently? And what lessons can we draw about how to operate strategically in the digital age? So the big thing we're talking about there is the way that he, in sending the email, thought he was having one type of conversation with me. He thought it was a conversation between him, an unruly professor, and the professor's boss. And I had the ability to turn it into a different conversation by taking a screenshot and making it a conversation amongst the entire internet about Brett Stevens and how heavily he's overreacting to the lightest criticisms.
I mean, how often do you get to come up in your weekly what's going on in the news? How often does the professor himself come up in those stories? I mean, this is great. I would think it's great if I was the teacher.
Honestly, man, it's so awkward, though. It's in the same way that, like, late in the semester, I write a lot about this stuff. So late in the semester, they end up reading my stuff. I hate teaching my own work. It is so awkward having a room full of students, saying to a room full of students, like, so what did you think about those paragraphs that I wrote? In the same way, like, having a, I, like, it's fun because, like, I did pretty well with this. So there's not an awful lot of, like, here's how I strategically messed up. But it's like, a little awkward having this conversation with students where basically what I'm saying is, let me brag to you all about how smart I am strategically and learn from me. Like, that's a weird flex for me to do, too. But,
you know, right, right.
If I'm going to do one of the news, I guess we'll talk about it. Sure.
Right. I haven't read your books, but one of them, I was reading up about it, Analytic Activism. And you talk about how, you know, what the activism that's going on online isn't just like a one-way street. You know, it's not just people, you know, with a call to action to get something done. There's also organizations and folks on the other end who are taking that information and sort of breaking it down to figure out what works and what doesn't. So
yeah.
Is that a correct, would you say that's a correct analysis of a summary of your work? So, what would you say is sort of like the lesson that a Brett Stevens could learn from this? Because it seems like he should be taking what just happened and thinking to himself, you know, maybe the digital strategy of emailing everyone who dares to bother me, not such a good plan of action.
Yeah, I mean, there's a general strategic lesson about, I mean, okay, so there's two big ones. One is understanding your own vulnerabilities and trying to stay away from them. And another, this goes back to Saul Alinsky from 1971, Rules for Radicals. Alinsky talks about how one of the most powerful tools an activist group can have when they're confronting powerful elites is ridicule. Right? And a big part of this story is how, facing ridicule, the guy just utterly melted down and then kept making mistakes, inviting more and more ridicule. So I think that's a big part of it. But in the digital era too, like, the way that things can spiral and spiral fast is something that he should have known about by now. Apparently he didn't. My guess is he'll understand it better going forward.
Right, right. You know, one of the things I've learned when I debate people on the other end of the political spectrum is that usually the best points you can make and sort of get the upper hand in a debate is literally just don't interrupt them, give them some room to speak, and they will end up tripping themselves up by saying something. You know, their true beliefs will come out and they won't sound so smart. And in this case, I'm talking about, you know, people and with Brett Stevens' beliefs, you know, climate change. This is a guy who's written about the disease of the Arab mind, which basically stems from he was bothered that a single Egyptian athlete wouldn't shake the hand of an Israeli opponent at the Olympics. I mean, if that doesn't tell you everything you need to know about someone, I don't know what else does. But, you know, so, I mean, this is sort of what happened here. I mean, you literally just call this guy a metaphorical bedbug as sort of a lighthearted joke online, and he's just constantly tripping over himself now without you doing anything, really.
Yeah, I've barely been dunking on him. I've mostly been in the rim. Like, he keeps a super real trunk on his face, and I'm just the rim, just sitting there. Like, all I really did was post the email and point at it.
Right, right. So where does this? I hate to call it a feud. Everyone's calling it a feud. You probably call it a feud yourself because it just sounds cool. I mean, I'm feuding with a New York Times writer, but like, where are we at now? Where are we at now with over a week away from you calling this guy a bedbug, a metaphorical bedbug? You know, that's even something I want to even just say again. You didn't even call him a bedbug. You called him a metaphorical bedbug, talking about a story where the New York Times had literal bedbugs.
Right, yeah. I just called him an irritating and difficult to remove. Yeah.
It's, you know, jeez. You know what? I think, you know, a bedbug, you try to get rid of a bedbug infestation, one thing they won't do is email your boss to try to get you fired. So...
Right.
So, you know, Brett Stevens, maybe bedbug is being too kind even. So where is this at? What is, because I know your provost put out an open letter basically saying that he stands behind you and Brett Stevens is welcome to the university. So what was that all about, and what does it look like it's going to happen?
Yeah, so he said to Brett Stevens, you invited CARP to come to your house. Why don't you come to GW instead? The idea is that the two of us can have a nice, civilized, moderated public discussion about civility and power in the digital age. That's right up my alley. I would love to do that. Brett Stevens told the provost and told the Washington Post that he accepted. We've been moving forward trying to find a date and set that up. I haven't heard whether a date's been established yet. Honestly, his Friday column was a surprise to me, and it felt like a mic drop. It felt like the thing that he would be doing when he's decided that he has won this thing and is done talking about it. So we'll see whether he's actually going to come to GW and have this conversation like he said he was, or whether now that he called me a Nazi in the pages of the New York Times, he's planning on running away and doing something else. We'll see what happens.
Right, right. I mean, I hope he does it. I mean, if anything,
he should.
Right, right. You know, and not to just focus on Brett Stevens here, but I want to get, you know, Dean Baquet of the New York Times has really been absent in this, and it's stunning to me that he would let one of his employees use the pages of the paper to do what he did. It's really like it was such a small online thing that he literally made sure to get in writing in the New York Times that this is what happened to me. I'm going to make it seem much worse than it was. I believe someone even pointed out that the one example he was able to find online of Jewish people being equated to bedbugs by the Nazis was actually in a book where they add the addendum, we believe actually from what it looks like was going on at the time, the person who said this was talking about a literal bedbug problem that was happening. Like, it wasn't even what he was trying to make it sound like. Mm-hmm. Have you heard anything from anyone at the New York Times? If not, you know, apologizing for Brett Stevens, just basically reaching out to you and saying, like, listen, I don't stand behind this guy, just offering some sort of support for you?
I mean, I have not heard anything formally from the Times, no. I will say, like, mildly in their defense, the Times has a rule that they copy edit their op-ed writers. They don't touch anything else about it. So it doesn't surprise me that they didn't stop this before it got into print. It does leave me wondering whether there's any consequence, though. Right? Like, this is an embarrassing article. And it's not embarrassing because he's conservative. It's not embarrassing because he's a never-Trumper. It's embarrassing because he devoted an article in the pages of the New York Times to a petty, small vendetta like this. Right. And so, look, before that happened, I kind of felt like the right thing that should happen is he should get made fun of online. They should probably take him aside and say, look, man, don't send those emails anymore. And that should be the end of it. But after that column, like, he should probably at least be suspended, because that is a waste of space. They can do better than that. And I'm not canceling my Times subscription. I still really like the New York Times. Michelle Goldberg is incredible. I read her like every week. I would not give that up, but they've got to have some pride. There's got to be some baseline of quality they apply to all their writers. And if this isn't below it, then what is?
Right. I mean, Brett Stevens could have used the space in the paper he spent going after you to go after one of your students.
Sure. Yes.
That's probably what will end up happening. If he does show up at your school, he's going to end up writing an article about how the students booed him and supported their professor when he came to town or something. I guarantee it. But I hope he comes.
Not even that. Like, one of my students is going to wear like a lapel pin he doesn't like, and he's going to write an entire column about how the lapel pin was offensive. That's how it's going to go down.
Oh, man. I'm riveted by it. It's riveting. I hope you take full advantage of this. I see you've been rightfully so doing what you need to do to defend yourself, but literally just milk it for all it's worth, man. I would do that if I were you, because this is, you know, you deserve whatever you get out of it. And I hope he gets whatever he deserves out of it. Professor Dave Karp, thank you so much for joining us. Where could people... Oh, yeah. One more last question. You had mentioned that your tweet calling him a bedbug had something like 0 retweets and like 4 or 5, 6 or 7 likes or something like that when you first tweeted it. Where are we at now?
9 likes.
9 likes. Okay. Got to give you some more credit than that.
But like under 10 is the... Like single-digit likes. I haven't checked today, but I think it was around like 40,000 likes and 3,000 or 4,000 retweets. It's this is going to go down in history as like the most seen thing that I ever write, which is like funny and maybe a little sad, but you know, we'll see what it is.
Right. I mean, you gotta, I mean, I don't see how you don't call your next book Bedbugs or something like that. I mean, it's,
I gotta tell you, man, like, I hope this is over. Cause like the joke has gotten so stale for me. I mean, like it was really funny for a week. And now I just want to like, talk about other things. It was so small, and it was so funny, and it got so weird, and now it's been so long.
Well, I will tell you actually that I haven't read the book, but I saw that your other book mm-hmm. is called The Move On Effect, and that is, both books mm-hmm. seem extremely interesting to me. I'm going to check them out. You know, another thing, I'm glad you called Brett Stevens a bedbug and he emailed you, because now I got two books to add to my reading list, because they seem great.
There we go.
Right up
there
my alley. You know, there was Occupy, there was Black Lives Matter, there was, you know, Ron Paul, Bernie Sanders using digital media to build up an electoral machine, and now mm-hmm. there's Brett Stevens and the Bedbugs, right up there with those very influential, important movements.
Weirdest week of my life, man. Weirdest week of my life.
Where can people find you online?
Clearly on Twitter at Dave Karp. I write for a bunch of places. I write at Medium, sometimes at Wired, sometimes I've written a couple pieces for Esquire now, but easiest is to follow me on Twitter at Dave Karp.
All right, Dave, thank you so much for joining me tonight. Take care.
Thanks, man.
All right, ladies and gentlemen. We got some extra time here, so before I bring up, we'll do something else a little bit fun on this episode, because this is a, you know, I don't think it's a completely, like, you know, he's, you know, it's a fun sense of humor, you know, the story has a sense of humor to it. Dave's a great guest, great guy, and, you know, but I think there is something incredible there that's literally just insane. Like, that a New York Times writer would do this. But anyway, patreon.com/Matt Binder. You know, we hit a nice number of Patreon subscribers. For the first time, we had 69 subscribers. I think we even hit 70 at a point. But then the first of the month came around, and you lose some subscribers. Everyone does when Patreon starts charging. And so we're now at a measly 66. So if you can afford to support this show, I would appreciate it so much. Patreon.com/Matt Binder. You can also support this show by going to YouTube.com and subscribing to the YouTube channel YouTube.com/Matt Binder and subscribing to the YouTube channel. What else can you do to support this show? Doomedpod.com. There's links to the iTunes link and Google Play, and I gotta get us some more places on the podcast. You know, I really enjoy doing the live stream, and I'm trying to grow the YouTube a lot, because I think that's where the future of this show is, and I think it actually is what sets this show apart. I mean, knowing from working at the Majority Port and talking with my good pal Michael Brooks with the Michael Brooks Show, being leftist media who run a podcast and also do a YouTube show, it sets you apart from most other the leftist podcasts, because not everyone does live streams. But with that said, a large number of this audience just listens to the show on the podcast. I have the numbers in front of me, and I can tell. So go to iTunes, go to Google Play. I'll get us wherever else you want me. Stitcher, Spotify, I'll look into all that stuff if we're not already there. Leave a review. Written review, star review, all that fun stuff. If you're watching on YouTube, though, you can also support this show with a one-off by leaving a super chat, giving me a super chat. I will read your, I'm saying that really funny, aren't I? Super chat. Super chat. You will be able to give a one-off donation, and also I will make sure I read your YouTube live comment and not miss it. That's my definite promise. Also, let me read the patrons now. I usually leave that to the very end. But, we got a little bit of time. So, These are the people who make this show possible. If you're a freebie person, these people are who keeps the show alive. Abigail T, Adam Q, Alan B, Andrew H, R.E.R., Benji, Bobby M, BZ, Champagne Kami, Chi, Christine H, Christopher S, Colin R, Dakota R, Dan M, Dank Uger, Dave K, Dave Z, Dragon Slayer, Fraz K, FTW All Day, Greg D, Ian Curtis J, Jameson Test, Janelle A, Jason R, Jasmine H, Jeff K, Jeremy M, John S, Jonathan B, Joseph R, Justin S, Katie S, Cats, and then Caution. Ooh, tongue twister there, guys. Lisa D and Lisa H, the Lisas. Machine Gun Etiquette, Max W, User Me, Michael B, Michael J, Michael M, lots of Michaels. If you'll notice, there's no Michael Brooks. You should all let him know that he's missing from this list. Mr. Danks, Nicole A, Namdenet, Null Style, Romina O, Ryan Left His Best, Scott R, Sean H, Stephen S, Struggle Session, Swizzle Malarkey, TM, Tamney G, Thaddeus A, Tina M, Tom G, Tom M, Why That Thai Guy, Will P, Wootopian, Zarin, and getting in just under the wire, our newest Patreon subscriber, Eugene B. We are now at 67, which means someone new will have the chance to be our 69th subscriber. Be the nicest of our patrons. All right, folks, before we jump into the patron-only portion of the show, this is something that's, you know, incredible to me. Incredible to me. Let me get to this story. It's not really a story. It's sort of a story. It's something I tweeted about earlier. If you follow me on Twitter, at Matt Binder, also follow me on Instagram, at Matt Binder, also like me on Facebook. Go to Facebook.com, search Matt Binder, I'll pop up. Like the page. If you want to follow the personal profile, you can do that too if you want. I don't really, I would like to start using Facebook and Instagram more. So there you go. Also, I believe I'm on TikTok as well, but there's apparently another Matt Binder on TikTok. So I'm Matthew Binder on TikTok. I'm not using TikTok right now. let's talk about this because it's getting retweeted a lot on Twitter. I tweeted this out. It's really funny. Also crazy. So you all know by now probably that Apple, as in the big computer slash smartphone company Apple, Steve Jobs Apple, Tim Cook Apple, Tim Apple Cook, Apple has a streaming video service in the works called Apple TV Plus, and not many details are known other than there's going to be some sort of newsroom-like morning show series with Jennifer Aniston. But I'm online today, and I see a story about how they've already canceled, they've already axed one of the shows that they had planned to fund. And it's a show they greenlit already, but it won't be happening under Apple TV Plus anymore. And the description of the show, really, I mean, it made me stop in my tracks, because it is a doozy of a description. It takes you places you never thought literally two sentences could take you. It's a show starring Richard Gere, that was set to star Richard Gere at least, and this is the description. I read it in 9to5mac.com, but they took this from Hollywood Reporter. It's a legit story. People think I made a fake screenshot, like people, like that Gorilla Channel thing that went viral. I did not do that. This is real, folks. Richard Gere was set to star as one of two elderly Vietnam vets and best friends who find their monotonous lives upended when a woman they both loved 50 years ago is killed by a car. Their lifelong regrets and secrets collide with their resentments of today's self-absorbed millennials, and the duo then go on a shooting spree. Well, I feel like I need to start pitching shows to Hollywood because, I mean, I could certainly come up with something, I think at least, more, I don't know, layered than that even? See, to me, this is one show here, ready? Richard Gere stars in one of two elderly Vietnam vets and best friends who find their lives upended when a woman they both loved 50 years ago was killed by a car. I find a show about two old Vietnam boomers, sort of like a True Detective type thing. If it was like, I don't know, Richard Gere and, I don't know, Tim Allen or someone like that on a True Detective-esque adventure to find the autonomous car who murdered their former lover. It would be a wonderful show, I think. Could be a dark comedy. A killer car being hunted by two Vietnam vets. But for me, a lot of people are pointing out, whoa, the shooting spree. Obviously, that takes it to the next step. But to me, what really gets me is that the resentment of today's self-absorbed millennials leads to the shooting spree. If you want, a kind read of this is basically, it seems like this show, what happens is the person driving a car is probably some millennial 20-year-old. Actually, I'll guarantee you it's probably someone who's like 18 or something. And they're wrong about it being about millennials because anyone with any sort of knowledge of the generational divide will know that millennials are no longer the young adults. I mean, we're young adults in terms of millennials are now in their, I guess some of them are still in their early 20s. But what's most likely is that they're talking about Generation Y. The YouTube generation. But anyway, what happens is probably someone's texting and some youngin' is texting and driving, as us youth tend to do. And they kill this woman by hitting her with the car. And then these two just go on Facebook, read a bunch of boomer memes and get radicalized. I mean, if this wasn't going to be a TV show, I mean, for all I know, let me rewind that, actually. For all I know, actually, the premise of this TV show was taken from a Facebook boomer meme because it looks like it could be one. Oh, I think someone actually might have tweeted. I wanted to see a Facebook meme put on camera or something like that. I'm just seeing this now. Oh, yeah, well, credit to that person. Where I can't find the tweet now. The way Twitter does this now, where you hit notification and everything just goes away. Ugh. All right. Oh. We just got another Patreon subscriber. Because we're not on the Patreon portion of the show yet, I'll let this person jump in. Jonathan L., thank you so much. The next patron will be the nice patron. 69, who will it be? If you're already a patron, do not unsubscribe and then resubscribe. Because you will not be 69, you'll just end up falling back to the... All right. Enough fun here. YouTube.com/Matt Binder. Patreon.com/Matt Binder. Majority Port gave a shout out to my pops today. Thank you, Sam, Michael, Matt, Brendan, Jamie, all the Majority Reporters who, listeners who wished well to my dad, who, is recuperating from his, heart attack scare last, week. Procedure went well. He's, currently getting over, his new diet, which actually is probably, following that will have longer lasting, effects to his well-being, his psyche, I should say, than the heart attack itself, I'm sure. he's probably gonna say something about that in the YouTube live stream, which I will read in the Patreon part of the show. Folks, see you all next time. Stick around for the members half on Doom.